Welcome to another edition of VCS Alumni Podcast. I'm your host, Bob Dresty. Today we are being joined by one of Victor's finest, Bill Kelleher. Bill's a 1989 graduate of Victor. We are catching up with Bill at the Syracuse On Center, where he and his band Mastodon will be performing tonight. His band has released 8 albums to date and has spent nearly the last quarter century producing albums, touring, and other projects. We are thankful that Bill has provided this opportunity prior to his show today. Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
I got to be honest, preparing for this interview, I did not know you at first. I knew the band Mastodon, but I never knew that the guitar player was from Victor. So I asked some of the people that you graduated with around your era there, like Tim Lachlan being one of them and stuff. A bunch of them, I said, do you guys know Bill Kelleher? And they all answered with the same 4 words. And it pretty much was like, oh, Bill? He's a great guy. You know, so you come highly touted by the people back home. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us about where you grew up in Victor and your family growing up in Victor.
I grew up on Raccoon Run. Yep.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty funny to think about that now when I tell people. I was like, yeah, I grew up on Raccoon Run. Like, wow, holy sticks. That's the sticks, yeah. But, you know, humble little neighborhood. And the cool thing about it was that, you know, there were no houses. It was a very brand new neighborhood, so there was lots of, like, we had a big hill in the backyard for sledding in the winter. And lots of exploring to do in the woods. And there was, like, a rock quarry behind the house and a big pond. And we rode dirt bikes and shot bows and arrows.
Yeah.
And played ninja and stuff like that. And a kid that lived across the street, Russell Woods, who was my age, he came from a whole family of, you know, his sister played violin and he played violin and brother played piano and oboe and all kinds of instruments in the family. So Russ and I immediately, when we got into rock and roll,
What age was this?
14, 15.
Yeah.
So I played guitar and he played bass and we would jam like Rush and Led Zeppelin, Van Halen all the time together, and you know, started getting into trouble and stuff like that together. And you know, that was it was a good neighborhood. We had Devin Arnold and Matt Santoro and Jen Santoro. Jen Santoro is coming out tonight, which is great.
Oh wow, is that the same Santoro that was a teacher? I mean, related?
No
relation. Okay, you remember Mr. Santoro?
Vaguely.
He was typing. They probably weren't teaching typing when you went through.
But. He was a typing teacher.
I failed typing. I don't think it was Mr. Santoro. It was someone else. I was horrible at it. Pretty good at it now, though.
Remember you used to have to do the time typing things? And I would sit there just like memorizing everything. And then when it came time to do the thing, I was like...
But I do, you know, everyone uses computers, but years ago I remembered my teacher had said about putting, I think it's the G and the H, you put your fingers,
that's what they say, that's the home
QWERTY, but you put your fingers around that and then you just learn how to do it without even looking. It's like playing the guitar.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So. At what age did you, I mean, we kind of went over a little bit of this, but at what age did you start playing guitar? And just give us a brief synopsis, as in detail as you want, about your journey to forming Mastodon.
It was a long time from when I started playing guitar, but I begged my parents for a guitar and I got one on my 15th birthday. All the guys I hung out with, it was about 8 or 9 of us, I was the last guy to get a guitar. And all my friends were playing, so I was like, I gotta have a guitar.
They're already riffing everything, right?
Yeah, they were, and I'll never forget. Everyone was like finger tapping, trying to do Eruption, and they're, you know, some of them are probably still doing that, you know.
Yeah.
And we all would sit in the bedroom and just try to play guitar at the same time. And there was a turning point in my life, and it was when I discovered punk rock. Because, you know, living in Victor and listening to the WCMF or whatever, all you heard was like your parents' music, like, and they're still playing the same Boston,
Foreigner,
Zeppelin, lots of Foreigner.
Yeah.
Great band, by the way. Every song, awesome. you know, all those...
Lou Graham doesn't listen to this podcast. No, I'm just kidding.
those ancient rock songs. But everyone was into that, and... At the time, you know, I was a very like a sponge, you know, I was just sucking up everything, very impressionable. And one of my friends, Matt Mickelson, he had found this punk rock tape and he brought it to me and he was like, listen to this tape. It's the worst music you've ever heard. It's horrible. And I actually took it home, listened to it, and I loved it. And I was like, this is incredible. What is this music from another planet?
Right.
So my trajectory from my friends just went that away. And what I learned from that was, oh, there's different music out there than just these guys who are on the radio. There's guys that are actually my age and they're out there doing it themselves.
Yep.
And they're touring, they're making records. And I had no idea you could do that. Like, right. You put your mind to it. And that was what the credo of like punk rock was. Like, hey, we're going to do our own thing. So that's what I started doing. I just started like learning some of these songs, started a band immediately. We played
with people from Victor or?
Yeah, because that's, I didn't have a, you know, I was 15 years old.
Yeah, right.
And it was me and Russ Woods and I think Joel Bashani and Bill O'Brien, who has the barbershop in Victor on Main Street. He was a singer. And we started a band and we played like we had a Battle of the Bands or something at Victor.
Yeah.
And we played that. And that's literally when I met my wife, which is crazy. 1988, I remember. We just started playing music and never thought it would be something that would, you know, take me around the world 20 times.
Yeah.
It was just fun. And my parents, you know,
were your parents supportive of it? Were
not,
they like,
not
you know,
really.
This is really good, Bill, because
not really. My dad was an immigrant from Ireland, and which makes me an Irish citizen, because I got my citizenship about 10 years ago, which is awesome. But he came to this country and he started with nothing. He had a couple stereo shops on Monroe Avenue. And you know, when I remember asking him, I was like, I want to go to college. I want to go to CCFL,
yep,
what it was called back then. I want to go for recording because I had no idea what I wanted to do. And he was like, don't get into the music business. Don't do that, because he was in it and I don't think he was a great businessman. But anyway, you know, he turned me on to like U2. He got me like U2 War, that record.
Yep.
And I had a really nice stereo system in my room, of course, because
I bet you did.
Dad, yeah.
Yeah.
Macintosh or
back then, like the Edge was a weird guitar player. Like he was very, very strange, non-traditional. You know, just played almost like a mandolin, like Irish folk music or whatever.
Right.
So I would learn a lot of their songs and you know, bug my dad a lot for, you know, I need a delay pedal, I need a distortion pedal, I need another amp, I need a guitar, whatever, strings, you know. Trying to think of like how to get from there to, okay, so I used to, when I was old enough, I would, Matt Santoro and I would, you know, he had the car, I didn't have a car yet.
Yeah.
So we would go up into Rochester, the big city, and, you know, start seeing touring bands and like local punk bands and stuff like that.
Bug Jar type stuff or?
Well, before Bug Jar, really, it was like, there was a place called the Citadel House.
Uh-huh.
And they used to have, you know, it was like an apartment, someone's house, and they would have shows in the basement or whatever, totally
right.
DIY punk rock stuff.
True underground.
Yeah, Rochester was like a hotbed for that back in the like late 80s, early 90s. There was a lot of like, there was Idols downtown, and like all these punk rock bands would come through, and we would sneak in, and I had a fake ID, and got busted a few times. And anyway, so, you know, I kind of learned from the whole thing. To me, it was like this mecca. It was so cool to like get away from this small town, Victor, and go into the big city, Rochester.
Yeah.
And it was dangerous and it was new and exciting. And
still is.
Yeah, no. And just, I just kind of weaseled my way into like being friends with this guy named Todd Worsham, who was in this band called Big Hair. And they were the biggest like kind of punk rock, almost new wave band in Rochester, and we became really good friends. And I mean, before that, I actually joined a band called Brave New World, which was Greg Esprulis from Victor, Jeff Backer, Bernie Talty, and me and Bernie are still great friends. I mean, I'm still good friends with Greg, and I mean, I just saw Jeff recently too. But they were the big Victor band, and they were, and I was like, oh, I love these guys. I want to be in a band with them. And eventually I got in the band. And then that took me to Rochester, started playing with Rochester musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And that just kind of led to, I was playing in a band with Kevin Cast and Jason Cast from Victor. I'm trying to think of who else.
Just outside my wheelhouse.
Yeah, and it just kind of led to, I was playing in probably three or four bands a couple times a week.
At age?
Like 18.
19.
Playing like Water Street, Horizontal Boogie Bar was called back then. There was like Back Streets.
Remember that?
I don't know.
Messenger.
There was Richmond's, which was Milestones before that.
Still there.
Not Richmond's. Maybe it is Richmond's, yeah. So I was kind of working the circuit, and I knew nothing about touring. All I knew was about getting on stage and playing my guitar and, like, you know, writing songs and stuff like that. I had no idea how. I just thought someone would come knock on your door if you played out enough in Rochester.
Right.
Like a record.
We're here. Where's Bill?
Yeah. Warner Brothers just come knocking on your door with a contract. Like, hey, we saw you guys in at the Bug Jar. We want to sign you. I just didn't know. I had no idea.
Yep.
Until, like I said, I moved to Atlanta in 97 and tried playing bands. I was there for almost a year. Moved back to Rochester solely because my old band, Lethargy with Braun, was getting back together. And they were, we're going to take it serious this time. We're going to record a record. We did record a bunch of records with, not records, but like tapes back then with, with a lot of my bands. But it was so expensive. Nobody ever had the money to do it. And we had to have a rent, rehearsal spot, which we never had any money back then. I could barely pay my rent.
Right.
And it all just kind of culminated into Lethargy. When I had moved back from Atlanta, you know, I'd kind of, you know, the guy that had left Rochester and come back, and I almost felt defeated. I was like, I got to do something. You know, I got to get this band off the ground. But
you got to ramp this up.
Yeah, it's like, but anyway, so it was shortly after that, Braun got asked to play in this band called Today Is the Day, and they're out of near Boston area.
Yep.
And I was like, dude, please take me with you. I'll play the triangle. I don't care. I know that band. I just saw them in Atlanta before I moved back, and they're a touring band. And sure enough, a few months later, he calls me, and he's like, hey, we need a bass player, and I know you can do it, so jump on a plane. Ended up moving there, played with that band. We immediately went to Europe. We toured all over the United States in a van and little divey club, slept on floors.
Yeah.
This is like 99. And I immediately was like, I know how to do this now. This isn't that hard, you know. And we were on a small record label out of Philadelphia. And, you know, I had ulterior motives. I was like, Braun, we're gonna leave this band because it was a three piece with a revolving door. One main guy who was in charge. He was a crazy person.
That's why there was a revolving door.
There was a reason for that. Yeah. And anyway, so
was he the lead singer?
Yeah, he's the singer and guitar player, and he wrote great songs. But with those kind of creative people,
right?
There's a little bit of madness going on.
My one friend calls that LSD, lead singer disease.
Oh yeah, for sure. So anyway, that just kind of led, you know, I was like, Braun, let's, Julianne at the time, my girlfriend, I was like, she's got an apartment that has an extra bedroom, move with me, let's go. He had never even been to Atlanta, and he was like, let's do it. I was like, even if you don't play drums with me, there's a million wanted ads for drummers or whatever, and it's nice and warm, there's no cold winters, it's a change of scenery.
World's your playground down here.
so he came down with me, and we just worked really hard. I immediately got a rehearsal spot, we started writing songs, just the two of us, and I was putting up flyers all over, and we met the other two guys, because literally their band was losing a drummer and a singer, and we needed a bass player and a guitarist, so we joined forces, and that old record company from Philadelphia, Relapse, they were like, whatever you and Braun do next, give us first crack at it. We'd like to, you know, hear what you guys have to
do. So how many years after they initially said that did this transpire?
Oh, it was very, very quickly.
Okay.
Because we, when we had moved to Atlanta and started writing songs together, we wrote 9 songs and immediately recorded them. And the other two guys in the band, Troy and Brent, because of their history in the Southeast, they already knew. Troy had a van, and we're like, "You got a van? Cool, we got a band. Let's do this." So we basically jumped in the van, and he. This is back in the day when we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have computers.
Right.
We had one. Julianne had a computer and one in the house in the kitchen, and we'd go in there, and there's this thing called BYOF. Book your own life.net. So you go on there, and it was like this network of like people's basements and storage spaces or whatever, where we could connect and network, and we could make a tour out of it. And we used to print out the Rand McNally paper maps like this thick, and someone would sit shotgun and be
"You got to write up here.
Oh, you got to get off at 16, and then hang on, that page didn't print out. You know,
wrong page."
And those were the days. You know, we would live out of our van, and we would just play in blood, sweat, and tears. You know, and eventually we signed with Relapse pretty quickly. We didn't have a lawyer or anything, which was an idiot move. Yeah, we did have a lawyer, but she didn't charge us. But that just kind of led down the road to where we were. We would just go up and down the East Coast like every month. We'd be playing the same exact places. And then eventually we started going out West, and we just got the attention. Usually what managers and record companies want is a band that's working.
Right.
Like, they don't care if you're good. That helps, but they really just want to know that you're dedicated and you're going to show up and you're going to play. Because I always, when kids ask me, like, how do you do it? I'm like, I'm still doing it. It's every day is doing it. There's no, "Hey, I made it." It's like, I can put the paintbrushes down now. It's never like that.
Right.
It's just a constant moving.
Evolving.
Evolving, yeah. And you always have to remember that it could all end at any time. And basically what that led to was managers starting to call us up, because we had a kind of in-house manager at Relapse Records. And he was like, "You guys are getting too big for me to handle. There's all this press that's coming in. There's all these people want to talk to you. You
Uncle.
Guys got to get a manager." Right. Yeah. So that was really scary, because there was all these LA managers, like these, just like you think in the movies, like totally slick. "We'll take you out for dinner." Then the record company is the same thing.
I can't even imagine what that's
like. "Let's take you out for dinner and let's do this." And there was one guy from Capitol Records who took us out. We were in Vegas, and I brought my buddy Todd Worsham from Rochester with me. We're in Vegas, and he's like, "I shit you not." I go, "Dude, order as much food as you want. Get the most expensive shit." We're at the Red Room, which is like a Russian vodka place. I'm like, "Order the most expensive. They're going to pay for everything." We were all just drunk out of our minds.
Yeah.
And I look at the guy and I go, he's like, "Yeah, so yeah, when do we sign? What do we sign with Capitol Records?" I'm like, "What's your favorite Mastodon record?" And I stumped him. He was like, "The one with the," and he didn't know. And I was like,
"Thanks for dinner.
That's all I needed to know."
He probably told his people, Bill, before he went in there, he's probably like, "Let me show you how to deal with these guys. I'll show you how to deal with these guys.
I've learned a long time ago that you got to question everybody and everything.
Yep.
Have street smarts. I don't believe, put your money where your mouth is. You know what I mean? Like,
totally.
You didn't sign with them.
Hell no. Nope. So we got a great manager out of it, Nick John, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago from pancreatic cancer, and he was like my best friend, and there's no one ever going to be like him.
Yeah.
And we've been kind of lost without him, honestly. It's been really tough.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still with the same management company, but Nick John was our friend and our dude. But having a manager to kind of steer us make the right decisions and get us to where we are today. You can't put a price tag on that. It was just amazing. And we started getting tours with bigger bands like Slayer. We got a tour of Slayer. I was like, "Oh my God."
Hello.
I learned every one of your songs in high school and used to jam them. And Iron Maiden, Metallica, we toured with those guys. Those are my heroes, you know what I mean? And now we're like on the same touring in South America with them. It was incredible. So
So for people listening who may not have heard of Mastodon, you know, some of these people, like maybe my age, I don't know, may not have heard of it. A lot of people just say, like, you're a metal band, but I've listened to a lot of your stuff. I go down these rabbit holes. And you ask her. And I'm going down this Mastodon rabbit hole now. But when I hear your stuff, it's obviously metal, but it's way more complex than just, you know, I grew up with, like, Priest, Maiden, Ozzy, all that stuff. This stuff is on another level where it is so complex. The syncopation, everything is, it's not your standard metal. How would you describe the type of music that you play?
That's a really hard question, but I mean, yeah, it is easy enough just to label, oh, they're just a metal band, but it's much more than a metal band, because I don't even listen to metal anymore.
Right.
Really. I'm all over the place with, if it's music and it's good, I like it, you know what I mean? It's not, a lot of people assume, like, oh, you guys must all just listen to headbanging metal all the time. I'm like, nah, I'm not really. In high school, I did, I was a kid, but.
I used to go to sleep at night with Priest on headphones, like blasting, and my parents were like,
"So that's what happened."
And that exactly, what the hell are we creating here? It's like,
you know, I feel like there's so many influences, and with our band, I don't feel like there's any real, what's the word? Still pretty early. For
can't
me.
Really pigeonhole ever. There's genre.
There's never any like. We can't go in those waters.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like everything is, as long as it's a cool riff that we all agree, like, that's a cool riff.
Yeah.
Like, Braun wrote he writes a lot of the vocal melodies, and he's like, don't tell the other guys, but that's totally ripped off from the Bee Gees. The total Bee Gees, because Braun loves Bee Gees, Bowie, Bjork, you know. We listen to, you know, a lot of Thin Lizzy in there with when you have two guitarists, you know, it's hard not to harmonize and,
right,
not just play the same thing all the time. And you know, I feel like you can see our and hear our influences, you know, we kind of wear them proudly. Metallica, Slayer, Rush,
yeah,
King Crimson. I mean, we really like prog rock is very cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like if you listen to our very first record and put it AB it with our latest record, you'd be like, wow, that's two totally different bands.
So I have, because I started like from the beginning, you know, some of the early ones.
Sometimes I tell people, start from the last record and work your way back.
That's so true. That's telling her. Lisa's like, wow, that is heavy. And I go, hang on, right here. Let's go to Hush and Grim. Listen to this. Yeah. It's like.
So it's such a, you know, and I try to tell, because, you know, fans are fans. If you make music or art for someone else, then you're not truly an artist. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Right.
For me, I'm selfish. When I write a riff or a song or whatever, I'm kind of doing it for me and to impress the other guys in the band. Like it has to pass
that bar
inspection. It's like, so I'm always writing. I always have my guitar with me, and I'm always trying to come up with, you know, test myself and do better, like you should.
Yep.
You know, a lot of our fans are like, no, they never put anything out any better than the first record. And I'm like, that's not true. Like,
right.
I'm a human being, and I mature, and I evolve. And
totally.
I get better at the guitar, and I have different ideas and different thoughts.
How does it work, Bill, when you're coming up with a new song? Are you working the riff first, and then, like, we'll put the words to it later? Or vice versa, or combination. Well, sometimes
usually, yeah, that's the way it works. Because no one ever in the band was a singer. You know what I mean? We're just like instrumentalists. You know, we would always write. We never even really think about, like, I think about songwriting so much differently now after working with producers and you know, guys who've been in the business longer and just growing. You know what I mean? So like. When we used to write in the first records, we didn't think about lyrics or vocals. We would just be able to scream over that stuff, and let's just write as much heavy.
Yep.
This riff's heavier than that riff's heavier than that riff's heavier than that riff, and just kill people, just bam, bam,
chunk
bam.
It.
But then we started like thinking about it, like, well, what if we put some dynamics? You know, we got to have some dynamics in the songs, and then we're like, as people got better at singing. We used to have a singer originally. He was from Rochester for a very short time. It didn't really work out. So then we had a tour already lined up, and now like, hey, now someone's got to start singing because we have these songs that are recorded with vocals. So everybody started, you know, some guys started taking vocal lessons, and you know, it just started progressing. We started thinking like, oh, well, this is the verse, and that's the could be a chorus, and maybe we don't play as many notes here, and don't heavy it up here and heavy it up there. So we started approaching it
instead of full on all the time.
It can't be heavy without some softness.
Right.
If you're heavy all the time, it's just like you just get numb to it.
Totally. Totally agree. So Mastodon has been a band for nearly 25 years. You have won a Grammy along with being nominated for 6 others, correct?
That's right.
This along with several other awards over the years, including Metal Gods Award in 2007. That is huge. I mean, that is... that's not three chord bill. That's intense. All these awards with one band over a 20-year period, it speaks volume to the dedication of the band members that you're with and also the bond that each of you must have. How would you describe life as a touring musician?
Well, in 2023, it's a lot different than, say, in 2001 or 2002, you know. Even after 9/11, things changed, and I don't know. That's a deep question, but you know, for me, my personal journey. When I first started touring, we were just in a van, like I said. You know, I was just the happy dog on a ride. Like, this is great.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I don't care. We're getting paid $50. Who cares? This is awesome. I'm getting to play in Joe's basement in Salem, Massachusetts or whatever.
Right.
You know, but when we got to the point where we did the Ozfest, and we did the Ozfest in 2005, they were like, you have to have a tour bus. You cannot tour in a van. You have to be professional. You have to have a tour bus.
They're here.
So once you get a tour bus, there's no going back to a van.
Right.
It's like when you sit in first class on a plane, you can't go sit with the Gen Pop anymore. So, you know, that was a big change. The getting into a tour bus, because now we have some dedicated tour bus driver. So it's like, oh, now what do we do now? We're on the bus for like 23 hours out of the day. Let's party and let's rage and all that stuff. And then I had kids and would go home from tour and I have to be not rock star Bill anymore.
Right.
I have to be dad now and like straighten up and take care of these kids and life changing moments. You know what I mean? And you know, everything is, it's been a bumpy ride, but things are really good now, you know. But as far as my kids are all grown up, and you know, the band's still around after 24 freaking years. And
you know something, you go to the Wikipedia page, there isn't like 18 past band members. It's like, boom, there's nobody left. It's like,
yeah, same four guys. And it's been, you know, it's been hard touring just because of COVID. And all the competition that's out there, and the price of everything. Like, people don't understand that. Like, for instance, we had to cancel two big tours in Europe last year because we were spending every day the amount of money we were making.
Right.
Which was $35,000 a day.
A day.
Just to, that's our guarantee. But we were spending that on our crew, on the bus, on the gas, on the train.
The
price of business. You know what I mean? So we're like, well, no, I'm not going to leave.
It's just grinding. Yeah.
I'm not going to leave home for a month and make $0, and everyone else gets paid. It's like, why? I'm too old to do that.
Right.
We're not a young band. It's like, we don't need to do that.
You can pick and choose. Yeah.
So what I do now is I had to supplement like that income. So I do guitar lessons every day. I run our merch. We have two merch stores. One is run by a major like big company that would give us a big advance and buy the rights to like cloth products like t-shirts and hats or whatever. But I started this poster business where we make posters for the tour, posters for every show. And with Relapse, our old label, now we're on Warner. We're actually not on Warner Brothers anymore. We've been on Warner Brothers for like 15, 16 years. We're just about to sign a new contract with a brand new company. I sell our records because we get paid in the records like 14% every time they repress them, which is great because we sell them on tour and we make that income. But, you know, when you're a musician and you're out there, they put you on this stage and they make you look huge and like, you're, oh, those guys must be billionaires and they're on this
big that fancy. Was one of my questions. What's a common misconception about?
Oh, hell yeah. they make it out that way. And when you go, when you really break it down, you know, there's, you have to, and I only learned this like years ago, like you have to rent out these places. Like these aren't, they're not just giving you this place for free,
right,
so that you can play here and they make the bar money or whatever. So you have to rent these places out for a lot of money. But you know, there's so many people in the chain before the musician gets paid, and no one knows that. For instance, like the t-shirts, like this is a big controversy right now. The t-shirt, say our t-shirt, like say we're touring with a bigger band like Iron Maiden, their t-shirts are $60. We have to price match their shirt, even though we would only sell our shirt for 30. But no, because you're touring with a bigger band, you have to sell it for the same price.
Because people probably be like, I'll just get the Mastodon. Exactly. I can get 2 Mastodon shirts.
On top of that, the venue wants to charge, they're going to take 20% just because.
Yep.
They're going to take 20% off of your sale. Your management takes, you know, between 15 and 20% of the gross of everything. So say the tour, you know, when someone says, hey, you're playing a show, and this is made up, but say you're playing a show in Syracuse, it's a $100,000 guarantee. I have to immediately think 30% off the top of that.
Exactly.
So it's not like that. It's not like, okay, so management takes 20, say they take 20, so now it's 80. And then booking agent takes 10. So it's not like it's not like they're just taking 30 off their top. They're taking 20% of 100, 10% of 100,
then it just keeps funneling.
I always have to think in my head, like, it's usually when I see a number like that, we have to think.
Is it?
we do have a formula. I'm trying to remember it. It's usually like, I don't know, like, okay, that's really like half of that is what we're gonna.
Right.
That the band's gonna see, but then that gets cut in half, and then there's, well, it gets cut in four pieces for each band member, and then my tax bracket is like 49%, so I have to think half that, and I'm like, is it worth it to get off my couch to play $100,000? That's like, that's amazing.
Yeah, right. People,
that's a lot of money, but with the cost of everything, and with gas and goods and shipping stuff, and everything adds up. It's just crazy. I'm not complaining.
Oh, I know what you're saying.
I just try to get it out there to the common like fan who's like, a $60 t-shirt. It's like, yeah, but we usually don't even see that money, because the t-shirt company, like they own it, because they gave us an advance, which we have to split with management takes their cut off that, which they deserve it. They've gotten us to where we are, and they work hard for us, but it's not all it's not all you might think it is.
It's not like you're playing for the door. here's everything.
I feel like sometimes, honestly, I feel like there have been times we've brought merch to the venue, and I'm like, we actually lost money.
Oh, that happened.
And there's been times where we've been on tour, I'm like, man, I remember when we were in the van, we were making more money.
Right.
We're making $1,000 a night, and we would just, you know, gas money, and then we'd get fed by the venue, and then we might sleep on somebody's floor, and I would send like $1,000 a week home. I was like, I can't do that now. I mean,
right.
So yeah, there's a lot of supplemental things that I do. I own a bunch of property back in Atlanta. I have a rehearsal facility. I own a studio that we recorded the last record in, that, you know, I helped build, and that was one of my dreams, you know, checklist.
Is that just for you guys, or is it for everybody?
No, it's open to the public. There's a lot of bands come through, and I have my partner at the studio. He's in house, so he's always there, like doing the legwork and putting the hours in. So
there's a lot of recording studios up in around Rochester. In fact, one of the guys from I don't know if you ever heard a guy, Bob Potter. Have you ever heard of him? He has a recording studio, and he's also like the head of the whole Finger Lakes recording program at FLCC. As someone who has made it to the upper echelon of music industry, what advice would you give somebody aspiring to go down the same path that you did?
Quit. No. Well, that's kind of a loaded question, because it depends on what you expect out of it. You know, if you're looking to go into playing music for monetary reasons, you know. Like my mom always told me, you should be a dentist, Billy. Yeah, it's a long, like AC/DC said, it's a long, long way to the top.
Yeah.
If you want to rock and roll.
Awesome.
Well, and also you asked him that about that you went in front of Congress for that, because there's no more record sales.
Go ahead. Yeah, yeah.
Modernization
of music. Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that? Or?
Sure. That was the MMA Act. So it's the Music Modernization Act.
Yep.
Because I'm a member of the Recording Academy Grammy Committee, they had asked a couple of members from every state to come down to Congress and basically go in and talk to your congressmen and state representatives, and it was all about streaming music,
yeah,
basically, right. And how there was never, and I'm probably really bad at explaining this, but back in the 70s when they wrote the laws, musicians always got screwed out of their royalties, but it was hard physical copies of vinyl records.
Yeah.
They never thought in 30 years there was going to be music flying through the air into your phone,
right,
where you could just download it and listen to it. They had no idea.
You mean there's something else other than record theater?
There's Camelot.
Camelot.
Oh, they never prepared for that. So they never wrote any rules or regulations on how to monetize that. So streaming platforms like Spotify, Apple Music, Pandora, all that stuff, they really don't have to give the musicians like anything legally.
Right.
And they barely, barely, barely do. So when I went in and sat down with, these head honchos, they had no idea. They're like, oh, we thought you guys were like millionaires making tons of money off Spotify. I'm like, no.
Right.
And here's why. Please sign this. And they did. They signed the Music Modernization Act.
That's awesome.
I don't know how, I don't know if it's gone into play yet and how it works yet, but I think Apple and Spotify, like, they tried to counter it. And basically, it boils down to this. My manager had told me, he was like, way back when Napster was around,
oh, yeah.
And I was always on the side of Lars Ulrich,
Yeah.
Because he was like, you need to arrest these people who are illegally downloading our music.
I remember when Napster first came out,
everybody was like, you rock star, yeah. You got millions of dollars, you're going to arrest like 15-year-old girl.
And yeah.
Like, well, I was like, I kind of agree with him. Everyone else is like, oh, you wait. It's like if you were a cook in a restaurant, you don't give your food away for free.
Right.
So anyway, my manager told me, he's like, so what's going on is like all these major record companies, Capitol, Warner, Interscope, Sony, whoever, they all couldn't sell records anymore because everyone's illegally downloading them from Napster. So record sales are making they're all sitting fat and high on the hog and spending all kinds of money on music videos and whatever. And nobody's buying physical copies anymore. They could not get together and agree on how to stream music. It took a computer company called Apple to walk in to every and go, we'll give you this much money if you give us the keys, the masters, the keys to the kingdom. And they literally were like, ooh, here you go. Because good luck, we have no idea how to do this. So Apple took the masters and started created Apple Music.
Yep.
And it was like, for 99 cents a month, you can listen to as many.
And so then they're paying back the musicians on the number of plays or whatever.
But it's minuscule.
And plus, they're the ones that report their numbers. You know what I mean? It's like, they're not going to be like, oh, yeah, we didn't do anything this month.
Trust me.
They didn't download any Mastodon this month, right?
Trust me. Like, I have Spotify account. I listen to Spotify. It's easy. It's great.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of my friends are like, I don't have that. I boycott that. I'm like, well, unfortunately, it's they're the devil, but you're missing out because now you can't listen to anything because they kind of got the stranglehold on it all. Yeah, I know they don't pay anybody.
Right.
And that sucks. But,
they're not going to change it.
How are you, we got to figure, that's why this MMA thing, came along. Like the drummer, he was a young guy. He was like a fill-in drummer for Aretha Franklin, came from Atlanta with us. And he's like, the only way she can make money, she's, I think, passed away now, but this is years ago. He's like, the only way that she can make money is if she tours. And she's like in her 70s. She doesn't make any money because she signed a bad record deal back then.
Yep.
And you hear her songs all over the radio, all day long, all the time. But she doesn't see any of that money because of this. There was no law.
Right.
About what these Wild West. To pay.
Yeah.
It's like when you walk into a bar and they got a jukebox and they're playing your song and people are putting money into it. Like they do have to pay. We get little tiny amounts of that because you have to pay for the right.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, ASCAP, exactly. BMI, BMG. All right.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I know I speak for all Victor alumni when I say that you are truly an awesome representation of someone who has made it in the music industry while remaining grounded and authentic at the same time. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you. Thanks. Awesome. It was a pleasure.